The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 8, Clues, Part 2.
Penguins are a lot more diverse than people think. In general, they're very good divers and they're limited to cold water. Most of their adaptations are to tolerating the cold and also to tolerating hunger, or large periods of hunger, because that's their strategy for raising their young. And they all sort of have the same breeding season in that they have quite a long time incubating eggs, raising the young, and then a period where they disappear off to sea. So the colony isn't active year round. It disperses as most of the birds we see disappear for winter. Some of them don't hit land in that time. So macaroni penguins just go to sea in the Southern Ocean and they stay there. My name is Tom Hart. I work at the University of Oxford and I study penguins. We know a lot about penguins, and it tends to come in two ways. There's been a lot of observations on them from the very early days of when Scott Shackleton and William Spears Bruce took down naturalists. Anything you can get from watching them for a long time. But that tended to be the areas that are sort of easiest to get to, or near those first exploration huts, the first bases. The next phase was GPS recorders, or you'd put a radio pinger on a bird and you try and triangulate it from several points and work out where it was going and how far. And then people put time depth recorders on that would reveal how deep they were diving and for how long and things like that. So that's revealed a lot now about what they do, particularly when they're at sea or when they're outside of the breeding season. But it still tends to be a bit anecdotal. You find a study colony and you study it because you get to know it. And you set up a field hut or something that makes it a lot easier. But that means actually we have very few colonies very well known. The 21st century questions are more global. You know, we're worried about things like climate change. Is that affecting Antarctica? How is it affecting it? We can't just look at these four or five really well studied sites. We need to understand on a much larger level. And the problem is, if we're only getting data from these easy to reach areas, we're biased against the areas that are less touched by humans. And that tends to be, that means we're tending to get information from those areas that have little sea ice, have a fishing industry nearby, have tourists and a lot of scientists nearby, because let's face it, scientists can be part of the problem as well as the solution. And so we're really biased in our results. So the big thing I'm trying to do is get global coverage. And if we're going to understand how this works, so we need to get the data and the clues from far wider afield. We need to deliberately go to those areas that give us that would challenge what we think. The kind of basic tool of an ecologist is go out and count something. And over time, you hope that this builds up a picture of, are they surviving? Are they not? You know, what is happening at a population level? But that's actually incredibly slow to respond. The fact that we do have extinction rates and we see animals declining worldwide shows you how big the problem is. Animals like us, we work really hard not to die. We're quite good at not dying. So whether we're alive or not, it's an indication of complete failure rather than an idea of, are you stressed or not? So if you can look for the behavioural indicators, they're far more sensitive to stress and whether you're doing well or doing poorly. So what that means in penguins and in populations is, can we look at a load of different colonies? How many of their chicks are surviving per year? And how hard are they working to feed those chicks? So what we do, we and collaborators in Australia, in the US, in Argentina, we go and leave cameras overlooking these colonies all around Antarctica and other islands in the Southern Ocean. And these cameras take a lot of photos. They might take anything between 20 a day and some of them we have on every minute, so that's thousands per day. What these cameras do is just take the same view lots and lots of times. And when we go through them, that enables us to say, when do penguins turn up? When are the nests first occupied? When do they lay eggs? When do the eggs hatch? And all these things. And we can even, with the really fast cameras, we can even look at how long are they spending at sea? How often do they return to feed chicks and things like that? So we're finally getting to the really sensitive indicators. So these cameras allow us to follow 100 colonies rather than 10. And with a precision we've never been able to get before. But those hundreds of thousands of images, I mean, we have over 500,000 so far. We can't go through all of them. And we're gradually training computers how to do some of it for us. But in the meantime, there's nothing quite as good as the human eye. So we've got this collaboration with Zooniverse, which is a citizen science site, and they set up Penguin Watch for us. So you can go and be part of this detection. You go, you have a 30 second to a minute tutorial on what we're looking for, and then you click on penguins, and by showing us where they are in the image, we extract the data. And that you click on adults, you click on chicks, you click on eggs. And comparing all of those images, we can say, when do adults first show up? When do chicks first show up? And how long does it take to raise a chick? And is it successful? That kind of thing. It's been running for a year. It started in September 2014. We've had over 2.5 million hits so far. It's about 50 million individual penguins we've got counted. And from about 250,000 images in the first year, it's been really successful. And this is what allows us to get that large-scale data. There's tons of individual images that are weird. I think the big surprise was winter behavior. There's a lot of penguins around in the winter. Given that's the justification for the krill fishery there, I think we're going to investigate that a lot harder. One of the other big tools we use is molecular. So we get genetics from penguins. And that's really important because partly we're looking at the population structure. So which colonies mingle or interbreed and which are separate. And because a lot of that is governed by the mutation rate, if you suddenly get these family trees where you get a kind of starburst of activity all coming at the same time, you know that the population must have increased. If we have enough DNA sequences from enough individuals, we can work out roughly what the population has done in the past. That's really useful for penguins because actually we want to know how have they responded to past ice ages and interglacials. So if we're trying to build up this picture of the threats to penguins now and what is a penguin and how is it going to respond in different environments, we need to know where it's come from, what it's doing now, and then we hope we can predict what's going to happen or where it's going. So the genetics is really giving us a far better evidence about what has happened in the very long-term past to the relatively recent past. The hope is that we have something that is predictive. We're doing this to understand, to try and make predictions about how penguins are going to change, or seabirds in general. We're also, you know, this is a toolkit that could be used worldwide. So let's say we can predict what is hurting penguins in Antarctica. We want to remove those threats. One of the reasons I think this is so confusing is that actually all of these threats are correlated. We get a strong climate change signal and a signal of loss of sea ice. Well, if you're a fishing vessel, there's no bigger predictor of like where you can go as to whether there's sea ice there. So things that are coming across as one signal, when you delve into it deeper, that might be another threat hidden behind an existing signal. So yeah, there's a precedent to make a difference. People want these data, and particularly when it's a lot of scientists coming together and looking for a consensus on what are the threats and what can we change. The challenge now is to repeat that on the Antarctic Peninsula. That's probably a bigger challenge politically, but there's precedent. And so, yes, if we provide the right evidence and the weight of evidence, you can definitely change policy.
For the latest about the penguins mentioned in this project, visit www.penguinlifelines.org/blog. You can also participate in the research by visiting www.penguinwatch.org. You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Lou Sumner, and produced by Steve Pritchard for the University of Oxford. For more fascinating science, follow us on Twitter and Facebook or head to oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk.